Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to talk real. Real Talk is the show that seeks answers to questions large and small, and today's question is a big one. Is America's democracy working for the people? If not, why not? Here to help us explore that question is Ricky Ott. She is founder and director of Ultimate Civics, a project of Earth Island Institute. She's also an educator, an author, an activist with a doctorate in marine toxicology from the University of Washington. She worked in Alaska on the Exxon Valdez and stayed up there for 28 years. Welcome, Ricky.
Thank you, Susan.
That's quite a resume. How did you get from Alaska and the Exxon Valdez to Ultimate Civics?
Okay, good question, because it's actually very direct. What happened was I was commercial fishing in Alaska, and I had meant to take one summer off after graduating with my doctorate just to sort out what a career with a PhD might look like. Did I want to go into, you know, environmental consulting or academia? I thought, oh, heck, I'll take a summer off. Well, I totally didn't count on falling in love with commercial fishing, with Cordova, Alaska, this little bush community, wild spaces, wild people, everybody all go-getters, self-starters. It was just like I felt like I was home. So I ended up staying and thinking, oh, just a few years won't matter. Well, that summer turned into 20 years. And after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989, the fishermen all looked at me and said, aren't you the one with all those fancy degrees? Get out there and deal with Exxon. And I found myself testifying in Congress, testifying at the state legislature in Alaska. And this is for a period of like 3 or 4 years in the aftermath of this. And finally, when I came home to roost in Cordova, there were a lot of social consequences of the Exxon Valdez oil spill that tore our town apart. So it was a matter, a real example in when you take the main financial revenue stream out of a fishing community, no fish, no revenue, what happens to a community? And it was very, very similar to the economic meltdown in 2008. So that was sort of my wake-up call of like, you got to roll up your sleeves, nobody's going to come and save you. And we... there went like really 16 years of my life. And that about three years before our so-called settlement, well, not really settlement, we lost at the Supreme Court level with the the Exxon Valdez case. People started in the community, started coming up and asking me, how did corporations get in charge of our democracy? I mean, we're fighting them in court. We're fighting them in the politics, the political arena. We're fighting them in the legislative arena. What happened to our democracy? And I said, I don't know. I'm a marine biologist. And they said, and this is not just one or two people. This is a lot of people just stopping me on the street. Said, well, you're the town philosopher. So could you please go and find out and come back and tell the rest of us? And what I found out so horrified me that it became the final chapter in my book, Not One Drop, which is about psychosocial trauma of these big man-made disasters and kind of like Humpty Dumpty trying to put your community back together again. The last chapter is putting our democracy back together again, because we don't rule. People think we rule. It's one of the, well, I'm going to get ahead of the story here, but okay, so I'll stop. But when I realized that this is a story that needs to be told, I put it in my book. I went on book tour right in the middle of the economic meltdown. And lo and behold, everybody was interested in how corporations came to rule, because they were the ones getting bailed out, not people. And so people said, well, you are suggesting that we amend the U.S. Constitution to establish that only natural persons have human rights and that money's not speech. How is one person going to do that? I said, it's not one person. If the rest of the nation feels like that, this is a 9-month book tour. I'll start a group and we'll figure it out. And that became Ultimate Civics.
Ah.
And Ultimate Civics' role, niche in this greater movement, is educating our youth, because that's kind of where I've, and that's another part of the story, figured out is the best place for me to be. And how I got to Vashon is the brief story is after the BP well blew in the Gulf, I had to put on my oil hat again. And I went down to the Gulf and ended up coaching people in communities down there what to expect and how to deal with it for a year. And after that year, that was 2011, Bill Moyer here with Backbone Campaign asked if I would come to the Localize This camp in August of 2011. And I'd already been looking for another base camp to relocate because Alaska's, I can't really amend the U.S. Constitution from Alaska. So I needed to be closer to the lower 48.
Another Washington.
So, and then I met a man in when I was dealing with the BP disaster just 3 weeks before I actually left. So we started a relationship and is way too far. And Vashon is middle ground. So we are base camped out of Vashon.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here, and nice to have you here with your expertise and your view of the world. You were talking about the BP disaster, and my head started comparing that to the Exxon Valdez disaster, because what you said about that was that the people lost in that one. How did they come out of the BP?
Lost. And it's because we, the people, really don't have control of our centralized government, and we and the institutions it has created, and some of those institutions being artificial persons endowed or enabled, entitled to human rights. We really crossed a wire there.
And I think most of us count the time that corporations became people with the relatively recent Supreme Court decision that gave corporations human status. But in your research, I was shocked to find that you discovered this was a long-standing issue as far back as 1800s when corporations were brought into the Bill of Rights.
Okay, so there's two questions embedded in here, because I was shocked as well. And if we're going to undo Citizens United, which seems to be like over 80% of the people in America, and this is a bipartisan issue, politicians do not know what to do with it. It's up to us, the people, to do this, to end corporate rule, basically. And people think Citizens United, but really, I learned, it's in the Democracy Timeline, that Citizens United is actually based on two prior Supreme Court decisions, one being the 1886 decision that corporations are equal under the law. They are persons equal. And what equal meant was they are, in the eyes of the court, equal means entitled to fundamental human rights. Okay. And the second decision and underpinning the Citizen United decision is the Political Money is Speech, the 1976 yes. decision. So it's actually about corporate rights. It's a two-prong approach to undo Citizens United. However, the second part of your question is, you think 1886 is going back in time. What I've recently discovered through the Vashon Library books, The Origin of Value, Chapter 2, details how corporations came, this body, this collective body, this corpus of people acting together with a goal in mind. That was actually, the first one was 495 BC. And that was to deal with feeding the geese that would be on the palace lawn and they would warn of intruders, and feeding the palace horses. They were contractors.
In what country was that?
Rome.
Wow.
Wow. I know. Wow. And then by 300 BC, they had sort of become established as corporate persons, artificial persons. And then the arc of this goes all the way to current news, like now with the UN Human Rights Council immersed in this very controversial issue of how do we balance transnational corporations and businesses and human rights, and where are the boundaries in all this? And the fact of the matter is that's a wrong-headed question, because once you've established that these artificial persons have human rights, these are the primary perpetrators of violations against human rights. And you've just enabled them with human rights. So it doesn't work. We need to undo it a little bit further back in time.
Can you elaborate a bit on how giving corporations human rights actually affects the way they operate in opposition to humans' human rights?
Yes. And what I've done, this is an incredibly complex topic, and I've had adult workshops around the country on this, youth workshops and teachings, and some of the more remarkable moments have been like when three lawyers who didn't tell me they were lawyers after the workshop told me, we never studied this in law school. And one advanced placement high school 12th grade teacher said, now, wait a minute here. I have studied landmark laws, and I only recognize two or three in your entire timeline of about 60 laws, what I'm calling key landmark laws. And he said, what's up with that? And I said, oh, you've been studying the laws, teaching the laws that built empire. These laws are the ones that tore down our democracy. And you could just see this poor teacher, his face was like, oh my God, what have I been spending my career on, you know? So what I've done is I've started with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom's timeline of corporate rights and power. And I've made that a people's rights and power, because there's artificial people and there's natural people, and the Constitution doesn't define the difference. Big problem, okay?
So what is the problem that creates?
Who is a person? And who is a person under the law? And because of that nebulousness, it's pretty clear we started our country with a revolution, and that revolution was started with Boston Tea Party, which was really against a transnational corporation, the East India Company. So we really... And this is an exercise. I have an interactive exercise to let people decide what did the founders mean when they wrote that word person? Hmm. And it's pretty clear. I think it's mentioned, I don't have that number in front of me. I actually counted the number of times that person or persons in the Constitution. And if you go and look through it, you ask yourself, what did the founders mean by this? And it's pretty darn clear. I mean, not to give away the answer. I mean, how on earth could you have imagined that they were talking about artificial persons? It doesn't work. Just look for yourself, okay? Don't believe me. Look.
Well, in 1857, according to your timeline, the Dred Scott decision from the Supreme Court ruled that African Americans were not citizens, and I think not even people.
No right a court has to respect. Persons with no right a court has to respect. I think that was part of the decision. So it actually starts with, believe it or not, with the Supreme Court just think of it. We have America. We have trying to figure out how this new government's going to work. And the Supreme Court is saying in 1803, hey, it's not going to work unless this board game, this constitutional board game that we have here, has an umpire, has like a referee. And so we declare ourselves to be the supreme arbitrator of constitutional law. We will decide. Now, the Constitution never did that. It was created checks and balances. So right off the bat, we got unbalanced, so to speak, by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made a following ruling in 1819, which is really foundational to this whole discussion. And that's the one where here are these corporate charters under a foreign companies, countries, England, Spain, France, that we had been warring with to separate our country. And suddenly we turn around, we're a new country, we want to do business with these same corporations that we'd been fighting, but we want them under our rules. And our rules started as very strict. If you want to be a corporation, you have to go through the parliament or the local state legislature and get passed. You know, you have to have a statement of purpose and a certain amount of time. We have rules. You can't be involved in the political process at all. That just goes downhill. And what happened was these foreign corporations didn't have business licenses. They had charters, and they wanted to know if a charter was a contract under the Constitution, because there's a contract clause of the Constitution mm-hmm. that says states shall not basically make a law that infringes the obligation of a corporation to fulfill their contract. Well, these foreign companies had charters. They didn't have contracts. So what the Supreme Court did was say that they came up with an economic theory, which they are not supposed to do, okay? And the economic theory was that first the court recognized that a corporation had standing under the Constitution, because right. in order to go into the court at all, you had to have standing. That's what the youth are going through right now with the climate case. Mm-hmm. They have to have standing in a court of law. The court has to recognize that you have rights, that they somehow were infringed, and the court can do something about it. So the court recognized these artificial persons had standing in the Constitution. Right off the bat, that meant the court created a new actor under the Constitution. Where in our Constitution does it use the word corporation? Go and look. Never. Okay? So, number one, breach. Created a new actor. And this is what the 1803 decision allowed. It allows the courts to be creative now a little bit here in their interpretation. So the first thing they do is they create a new actor. They invite corporations in. The second thing in the same decision, 1819, was to come up with this economic theory that corporate charters are contracts under the Constitution. This is an economic theory that could and would allow courts to weigh the corporation's economic needs against our fundamental rights, against our human dignity, our freedom, our equality. These are like even worse than apples and oranges. They don't even belong in the same ballpark.
This is fascinating. You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHOP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host here with Ricky Ott of Ultimate Civics. We can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who makes all our information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Ricky, you are identifying for us the glitch in democracy that occurred when the Supreme Court, first of all, decided that they were the ones to make all the rules, and secondly, gave corporations standing in the Constitution. Can we fast forward now to a study you referred to before we began this on-air conversation from Princeton that showed that we are now, in 2014, this study was completed, we are now living under an oligarchy. And where is our democracy?
Where is our democracy? Our democracy lives in the hearts of people and the hearts and minds of U.S. citizens and Americans. It really does. I have traveled all over this country doing this work in different regions, and I am here to say that the embers burn strong. That's where democracy really, really lives. So those rules, the Supreme Court's sort of creative interpretation of the law, allowed, once corporations became equal under the law in 1886, corporations began plucking our fundamental rights one at a time. They got the Bill of Rights, which is used against federal government. It's a people's defense against the tyranny and oppression of a centralized government, federal government. Then with the 14th Amendment, same 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment was like a switching station where the Bill of Rights took the Bill of Rights and said, we get to apply this against states now as well. So corporations went on to get standing in the Bill of Rights against the federal government, standing in the Bill of Rights through the 14th Amendment to apply Bill of Rights protections against the states. They got all this leading up to, and here's sort of the and I'm getting to your question, but just a little scaffolding, the sort of second uprising, I count the first one, the really coordinated blacks and whites working together saying things aren't right for us. That was the Civil War and the resulting amendments, and there was a huge moneyed power backlash to that leading up to the next sort of uprising of whites and blacks and all people of color working together. And that was the 50s, 60s, 70s when a whole bunch of civil rights went through. And we are now in the post-Powell memo era. The Powell memo being a secret memo in 1971 of the to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, concretely and concisely laying out how to take back America from the corporate perspective, take over our education system, take over our politics, take over the media, and most importantly, take over the judiciary. And the judiciary would be key. And what resulted from that was a series of amendments that have eroded, Citizens United being one, that have eroded our free and fair democracy. And that is all done through the another economic theory of the Supreme Court, that money is speech. And the only person that empowers class of persons is people who don't have a voice but have to spend money, which would be the corporate persons, the artificial persons. And so with that, I mean, a central tenet of democracy is that we have free and fair elections. We don't anymore. We don't.
Because the requirement for huge amounts of money.
Huge amounts of money, but also who is doing the spending, unlimited giving, dark money, you know. So yes, all of that leading to what I call like Oz, where you have this wonderful curtain with democracy written on it, and behind the curtain are the hands on the levers. And they are not our hands. They are not the hands of the people any longer. And this was the Princeton and Northwestern University study in 2014, as if we needed academics to tell us, but it always helps, that it's official, people. We are not in a democracy anymore. We have all the characteristics and symptoms of living in an oligarchy. That's nice. Academics always point to problems. But now it's like, great, what do we do about that?
And what exactly does that mean when we say oligarchy? What define that?
Okay, it means exactly what they found in their Princeton study is that the majority. What we teach, the central tenet that we teach about civics is that the majority rule through our elected officials. They're not listening to us. They stopped that a long time ago. It's the economic elite that they're listening to. And Princeton and Northwestern have heaps of data to show that. It doesn't matter. We don't matter. We have been marginalized by our own government, and we have allowed this to happen. So when there's other examples out there about how we like take this back.
How do we do that? And who has done it?
The Nordic countries, so I'm talking about Iceland and Norway and Sweden and the Finns, they all collectively, there's a book called Viking Economics that's very well written and understandable. And basically, when they realized that the politicians were not listening to any of them anymore, they took to the streets. And they took to the streets to open what Terry Tempest Williams calls the open space of democracy. We need to have the conversations. Like, for example, my civics lessons, teachers have told me, oh my gosh, we teach judicial review, 1803 is a good thing. And I'm like, well, maybe it's time to start asking questions. That's all the civics lessons are about. It's about opening questions, opening inquiry, stimulating conversations. Let's figure it out. We need this open space to happen. And it tried to happen with the Occupy camps. But that's how things start. But those Occupy camp discussions came back into our communities. It didn't go away. And this timeline was one of the favorite teachings at the Occupy camps. Not because it helped anybody forward their own issue, but it helped bring all these disenfranchised Americans together to really understand that we're not crazy. We don't have a functioning democracy anymore. We really don't.
So what did the Vikings or the Nordic countries do besides go to the streets to break the oligarchy?
They had the discussions. They have what's happening in Canada right now with the Leap Manifesto. What's happening in the United States? There's all this media focus on the democracy, you know, a democracy convention that's being called who? By the corporations. Well, where's all the media attention on the democracy convention that's been going on since 2011, I want to say, because I was at the first one in Madison, Wisconsin, where people are getting together and having these discussions. What is our vision? What is our goal? What is it we're trying to do? Who's going to work on what? Canada, they've already produced the Leap Manifesto, which is a pretty well-articulated vision. What the Nordic countries did was they came up with a new economic model. How can we take control of our own economic model? And then they pushed that back. So they have a lot of cooperatives, which are very popular now in America too. Mm-hmm. But I think the central take home for me from, and look at what the Norwegians did after the 2008 meltdown. They didn't just roll over and say, okay, bail out the big banks. That didn't go. They took to the streets again and said, we're not going to accept austerity. We're not going to accept this. We're going to figure it out. And they forced a different way of to their politicians.
So how would we apply that method to the United States?
Okay.
Because the first thing, frankly, that comes to my mind is when we take to the streets, they start shooting us. Our government starts shooting us.
There's probably going to be some of that. But that doesn't stop people from taking to the streets mm-hmm. in every successful movement. I mean, it certainly hasn't stopped the African Americans, to point to one of my...
Certainly hasn't.
You know, why is it going to stop a bunch of white people? Come on. Come on. We gotta warrior up, as they're saying in British Columbia. My grandmother said, said a high chief at a rally I was at. My grandmother told me this morning, it's time to warrior up. So
it's a t-shirt.
So how we do this, we have to find our niche. Gene Sharp has a beautiful couple of pages, 198 methods of nonviolent direct action. Find what you're comfortable with. Find your group. Find your team. Find your voice. Find your power. Find your passion. This is not about necessarily writing resolutions, okay? So my passion was realizing at the Occupy camps, how did all these young adults come here without not knowing how to do democracy? I mean, it's so much more than going and voting. I mean, my God. You know, how do we dialogue? How do we find common ground? How do we agree on ways forward? That I took it back and went to the universities and said, nope, 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 they're too late here. Went to the high schools, nope, too late here. And finally found my niche with middle school students, because the middle school students, a lot of them are like wowed right now by kids their own age who are suing the federal government. Well, how does that work? Well, you have to have rights that are infringed. And you have to know how the court system works. And so there was an opportunity to develop this entire civics course to scaffold to lesson 6, which is climate justice for these kids. Kids want to know, by God, it's a teachable moment. Let's skill up.
In the minute that we have left, Ricky Ott, director and founder of Ultimate Civics, I want our listeners to know where to find you and where to find the timeline that we keep referring to, which is a timeline devoted to understanding how human rights in our country have been both eroded and revived from time to time. So please tell us, where do we find you?
UltimateCivics.org. There is a research source page, and on that resource page, there is our timeline of rights and power. There, the intro video, a little quick intro video. There's also a timeline stories, which is the story side of every single one of those cases that's up there, and a timeline summary, which is the what you see on the page, the date, and then a quick synopsis of what this is. UltimateCivics.org. I'll put up the timeline resources too. If you want to go more in depth, look at the lessons. They're all up for free. PowerPoints, files, everything. Middle school students are up now. High school students are going up within these next 2 weeks. you know, let's do some public workshops. Let's revitalize civics in our hearts, minds, schools, and common public spaces.
Ricky Ott, I can't thank you enough for joining us. You've been listening to Real Talk. We're talking about activating our democracy. And that is what Ricky Ott is about at Ultimate Civics. Thanks for listening to Real Talk. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime and Fridays at 6. I want to thank Luke McQuillan. He is the composer and performer of our theme song. Thanks for listening.